it's Monday, the 24th of August. My name's Douglas Hardy. Today, the Scottish Parliament is recalled for the Justice Minister to face questions over his decision to release the Lockerbie bomber.
The flag has all been taken so far by the Scottish government. It was the Scots, in particular, the Justice Secretary, Kenny McCaskill, who took this decision.
Labour is accused of emasculating the cabinet as government becomes ever more centralised.
Lord Turnbull, now he knows about Gordon Brown because he was cabinet secretary, but famously said that Gordon Brown had acted with Stalinist ruthlessness.
And there are new calls for rules on foreign doctors working in Britain to be tightened, following the case of a German doctor who killed a man during his first locum shift in the UK.
As far as I'm aware, there's been no changes to the British system either, and there's nothing to stop this happening again today.
First of all, Bill Overton has the news and a look at today's papers.
The Scottish Parliament cuts its summer break short today to discuss the release of Lockerbie bomber Abdulbasid Ali al-Megrahi. The Scottish Justice Secretary, Kenny McCaskill, will make a statement to Parliament defending his decision to release him on compassionate grounds. The 57-year-old, who has prostate cancer, returned home to Libya on Thursday to jubilant scenes which included people waving Scottish flags. The decision has been strongly criticised by the United States. Thousands of Greeks have had to abandon their homes as forest fires continue to burn around Athens. The government's now declared a state of emergency and mobilised the army in the capital. At least six major blazes are reported to be still out of control, and strong winds are continuing to fan the flames. More than 90 fires are thought to have started since Saturday. The mayor of one of the affected suburbs says he believes the fires were started by arsonists clearing land for developers. An opposition candidate standing in Afghanistan's presidential elections has reported allegations of widespread fraud. Abdullah Abdullah said he has evidence voting had been rigged in favour of incumbent President Hamid Karzai. The Electoral Complaints Commission, who are investigating his complaints, say they have over 200 reports of intimidation, violence and ballot box tampering. Afghan and Western officials have declared Thursday's poll a success, despite a turnout as low as 5% in the most violent areas of the country. But a senior UN official warned there would be no real legitimacy if Karzai claims to have won on the first round. Nearly a fifth of Britain's honeybees perished last year, experts say, increasing fears the species is in serious decline. Although the death toll is lower than the previous year, when nearly a third of hives didn't make it through the winter, beekeepers say it's double the acceptable level. In sport, the Queen's led tributes to England's cricket team after they reclaimed the coveted Ashes from the Australians, but there is unlikely to be a repeat of the open-top bus parade which followed the last Ashes victory in 2005. The team flies to the Irish Republic on Tuesday for a one-day international. And in football yesterday, Spurs beat West Ham 2-1 to give them their best league start for 49 years. Chelsea beat neighbours Fulham 2-0 and Burnley took a goal after only 40 seconds to beat Everton 1-0. Now for a look at today's papers. The Ashes are back home, the headlines say, with photos of England's cricket team spraying champagne around on every single front page. The main news story of the day, though, the growing row over the decision to release the Lockerbie bomber on compassionate grounds. The Mail warns it's payback time and reports American consumers are being urged to boycott British and Scottish exports in response. The Telegraph leads with the pressure on Gordon Brown to break his silence over the release. Mr Brown has kept quiet since it was revealed he had more detailed discussions with Colonel Gaddafi than was previously known. And in other news, the Telegraph reports that just days before GCSE results come out, fewer than a quarter of pupils gained good passes in the core subjects. The number of pupils getting 5 A to C grades in English, maths, science and languages has fallen every year since 2001. You can keep up to date with all those stories and more throughout the day at guardian.co.uk.
The Scottish Parliament returns to business a week early today for Justice Minister Kenny McCaskill to face questions on the release of the Lockerbie bomber. Gordon Brown is also under increasing pressure to provide some answers after The Observer reported that he and Colonel Gaddafi discussed the possibility of Abdulbasid Ali al-Megrahi being allowed to return to Libya up to 6 weeks ago. And a letter written by a Foreign Office minister to Mr McCaskill also appears to cast doubt on assertions that Westminster played no part in the decision. The Scottish authorities remain defiant, with First Minister Alex Salmond saying, "We didn't do it to court popularity." I asked our diplomatic editor, Julian Borger, how much pressure this puts on the government.
The pressure is obviously growing. It's not going away as the government had hoped. especially as, from Gordon Brown's point of view, Muammar Gaddafi wasn't all that helpful this weekend, thanking his good friend Gordon Brown for his courageous support of Megrahi's release. It's not the sort of support that Brown was looking for, and it's likely that over the course of the week, you know, the pressure will build up on him to at least declare a view on whether Megrahi's release was right or wrong. And just as David Miliband was under pressure a couple of days ago to do the same thing, and he ducked it. You can see why, because obviously it's in the British government's interest not to declare their hand on this. It's won Britain a lot of goodwill in Libya, which translates into contracts and good commercial relations and so on. And of course, the decision was taken instead of the British government by the Scottish government. And so as far as British public opinion and US public opinion is concerned, the Brown government can wash its hands and say, well, it wasn't us.
Do you think this will really translate into to good news for any UK businesses who are seeking trade there after this has happened, after Gaddafi has essentially, as you said, made a bit of a fool of Gordon Brown, perhaps the Scottish Parliament?
What is likely is that the Megrahi release will mean that there won't be any bad news for British companies operating in Libya. The Libyan government has a bit of a track record when it disapproves of some decision taken by a foreign government of taking retribution against that country's company. So it's quite possible that if Megrahi hadn't been released, there would have been some kind of reprisal in terms of British commercial interests in Libya.
And what about the diplomatic backlash from the United States authorities?
Well, the head of the FBI, Robert Mueller, wrote a stinging letter to the Scottish government, but the flag has all been taken so far by the Scottish government. It was the Scots, that, in particular, the Justice Secretary, Kenny McCaskill, who took this decision, took responsibility for the decision. He's been backed up by his party leader, Alex Salmond. And so the government in London, the Gordon Brown's government, has been able to duck that American backlash and shrug their shoulders and say, well, it wasn't us, it was those Scots.
But if it emerges that there was involvement from Westminster on whatever level, that could be more serious.
Yeah, it could be. So far, it's hard to see a smoking gun. The closest to it is a letter by a Foreign Office Minister, Ivor Lewis, to the Scottish government, saying, well, there's no legal hurdle to the release of Megrahi. Now, the Foreign Office say that was simply a factual response. If it turns out that it was more than that, that it was an encouragement to release Megrahi, then the Brown government is in hotter water. So far, you know, the gun has been found, you could say, but it's not exactly smoky. You were talking about an SNP government in Scotland, not one that is politically or historically inclined to do the bidding of London. So it's hard to see how a letter expressing an opinion from London would constitute pressure on a Scottish government that sees itself independent in these issues. And so far, the Brown government is not in that kind of trouble, but more may emerge as the days go by.
And that was Julian Borger. You're listening to Guardian Daily with me, Douglas Hardy. Cabinet government died a long time ago, and that is a good thing. Those are the words of Jonathan Powell, former Chief of Staff to Tony Blair, in response to a damning indictment of Labour's handling of Whitehall by four former cabinet secretaries. They've given evidence to a House of Lords inquiry into how government is run, and say that cabinet is becoming marginalised, civil servants bypassed by greater political control, and they warn Britain's constitutional settlement is under threat. Our chief political correspondent, Nicholas Watt, has the story.
Well, the House of Lords Constitution Committee, that doesn't always make the news every day, is conducting an inquiry into the way Britain is governed. It's looking at the Cabinet Office, and they've heard evidence from four former Cabinet Secretaries. Now, these are the most senior mandarins in the land, and the four former Cabinet Secretaries they've heard from, they held that post in all between them 26 years. They served three Prime Ministers, that's Margaret Thatcher, John Major and Tony Blair. there, and they are not happy. They believe that in the last decade under New Labour, that cabinet government, the traditions of cabinet government have been bypassed, that Tony Blair and Gordon Brown, if you like, sort of conduct business in a cell. They just have their sort of individual favourites, and the conventions of cabinet government are not observed. Now, one of the really interesting comments is from Lord Armstrong. Now, Lord Armstrong was cabinet secretary under Margaret Thatcher. He held the post from 1979 to 1988, and he famously coined that phrase about being economical with the truth. Now, Margaret Thatcher, everyone thought at the time that she wasn't very favourable towards cabinet government. Well, Lord Armstrong said, well, Margaret Thatcher, she did actually, she did observe the rules. Yes, she could be a bit of a bully, but she did observe the rules. But he says, Tony Blair, oh, no, no, no. He has amassed power and not observed convention in the way that Margaret Thatcher did.
And what about Gordon Brown? I mean, the follow-on, obviously, from Tony Blair. Has he, you know, he promised to kind of, you know, push away sofa government and it was all going to be inclusive again. Has that happened?
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? Because Margaret Thatcher, she was seen as being far too centralising. John Major took over in 1990 and famously was interested in cabinet government and was pretty genuine about that. And Gordon Brown really tried to do the same thing, or gave the impression that he was trying to do the same thing when he took over from Tony Blair 2 years ago. But interestingly, Lord Turnbull, now he knows about Gordon Brown because he was cabinet secretary, but before that he was permanent secretary at the Treasury, famously said that Gordon Brown had acted with Stalinist ruthlessness. Well, Lord Turnbull says that Gordon Brown knows a thing or two about politicising matters, and he talks about that when Gordon Brown was Chancellor, he created, this is Lord Turnbull speaking, he created this thing called the Panel of Economic Advisers. That all sounds very grand. And then Lord Turnbull says that was just a smokescreen to get more special advisers in.
Now, if, as these senior figures assert, cabinet government is dead, it's finished, it's on the way out, is that, does everyone kind of think that's a terribly bad thing?
Well, there are some people who think that's a good thing. And interestingly, Jonathan Powell, who was Tony Blair's chief of staff in the 10 years that he was prime minister, in his evidence to the House of Lords committee, he says cabinet government died a long time ago, and that's a good thing. And the reason why he says that's a good thing is that the cabinet, remember, there are sort of 23 people sitting around the table. That's not a good forum for making decisions. You have people in there who don't know anything necessarily about the question, the key question that could be under consideration. Far better, he says, to do it in cabinet committees. That's committees of the cabinet, smaller grouping of people, where you have people who know what they're talking about. Traditionalists, they'll all be wanting a return to the days of the 1970s, when, under Harold Wilson, cabinets would sometimes last for 2 days, and at the end of it you'd have a vote, and the Prime Minister wouldn't know which way that vote would go. Now, that was good cabinet government. That was perhaps democracy at work. But was the country a tidy, a friendly, a well-run place in the 1970s? Some would say it wasn't.
Now, if, say, the Tories won the next election, do you think we'd see any great changes under them? I mean, they've obviously criticised Gordon Brown and indeed Tony Blair's style of leadership. Would they make any changes?
Well, it's interesting about what David Cameron would like to do. He is in discussions with Sir Gus O'Donnell, the cabinet secretary, about the changes that he would like to introduce. They're talking about setting up a mini West Wing in Downing Street, where David Cameron and George Osborne would work closely together. That is designed to ensure that they do not make the absolutely fundamental error that New Labour made, which was essentially that the Prime Minister and the Chancellor, Tony Blair and Gordon Brown, didn't get on. They want to avoid that mistake. I think that there would be similarities in the sense that the pretty tight group in David Cameron and George Osborne's joint office that they have in opposition, I think most of the people in that office would find themselves into the new West Wing in Downing Street. But certainly David Cameron has talked about restoring cabinet government. There was a democracy task force. But often that's what people say when they're in opposition. Let us not forget that a lot of people think that Margaret Thatcher, despite what Lord Armstrong said, that she centralised a bit. But then her first Lord Chancellor, Lord Hailsham, famously gave a lecture in 1976. And he talked about how Britain was governed by an elective dictatorship.
And that was Nicholas Watt. This is Guardian Daily, also on The Guardian's website today. Mark Ravenhill looks at the fabulous life of drag queen Bette Bourne. Go to guardian.co.uk/arts for more on that. Charlie Brooker investigates how screens have taken over our lives and are set to do so even more. guardian.co.uk/G2 for details there. And go to guardian.co.uk/business to find out more from economics editor Larry Elliott, why we must all really start preparing for the age of austerity. Now, last year, a German doctor killed a patient accidentally during his first shift in the UK as a locum GP on out-of-hours duty. 70-year-old David Gray from Cambridgeshire was given a massive overdose of a pain-killing drug by Daniel Yubani, who later apologised to the family, saying he was tired, stressed and confused by a drug he was not familiar with. The doctor was later convicted in Germany of causing death by negligence, while a manslaughter investigation was underway here. The case could have wider implications about patient safety and the rights of foreign doctors to work here. Finlay Scott, the chief executive of the General Medical Council, the profession's regulator in the UK, has told The Guardian's James Meikle the rules must be tightened.
Our basic approach has been pursuing two main lines. The first one is that regulators throughout the EEA should notify other countries whenever they have knowledge of doctors who are a risk to patients. And I have to say we are making some progress there. The second main line is that there should be changes in how minimum standards are defined in terms of what leads to a qualification to practice. The main obstacle to progress here is because of the European Commission's insistence on the primacy of freedom of movement without, as we would see it, a sufficient regard to patient safety. Our job is to protect, promote, maintain the health and safety of the public. In general, we think we do a pretty good job. And the great majority of doctors working in this country are good doctors. And this includes many who come from within the EEA. However, I always feel angry and sad when patients are damaged by what is a very small minority of doctors. Because for those patients, the system has failed. We can never be complacent.
Steve Field, chairman of the Royal College of GPs, agreed.
I'm really worried about doctors coming in from Europe who have not got the appropriate knowledge or skills. They seem to be able to waltz in and waltz out with relative freedom. I think there are a number of changes that are needed. First of all, we need to ensure that doctors coming into this country are of the same standard that we would expect of GPs. Our college examination, the membership of the Royal College of GPs, ensures that UK doctors are at an appropriate standard. Doctors coming in from Europe do not have to have the equivalent standard.
Change would have to happen at a European level, but the British government has so far given little outward sign of wanting to rewrite the rules. The Guardian has seen a letter written by the Department of Health to David Gray's son, Stuart, who's a GP in Worcestershire. He is very, very disappointed by their response when he called for a review of Out of Hours.
I felt there needs to be an overall national level of Out of Hours policy, and so I wrote to the Minister of Health requesting an urgent review. But I got a rather disappointing letter back. It was somewhat dismissive of my request, and in fact, in some areas, is quite arrogant and rather patronising. In fact, it says in no uncertain terms that he had no plans for a broader independent review, and went on to pontificate about how wonderful the out-of-hours service is at the present time.
Stuart's brother, Rory, who works as a satellite engineer in Germany, continues to be frustrated by the response of the government and the authorities in Germany, where Yubani, though now suspended in this country, is still being allowed to practice.
Well, it's absolutely staggering. I mean, he's still allowed to practice in Germany, and as far as I'm aware, there's been no changes to the British system either, and there's nothing to stop this happening again today.
Rory Gray ending that report from James Meikle. One of the goals of Barack Obama's administration is to change the perception that in Middle Eastern politics, the US is always on the side of Israel. His government, along with the rest of the international community, is putting pressure on Israel to halt the growth of settlements on the West Bank so that there can be a return to serious peace talks with the Palestinians. Publicly, the Israeli government says it will allow no new settlement to be built. But as Rory McCarthy reports from the West Bank, the reality on the ground seems to be very different.
This dusty hilltop is called Shtema, and this is what the debate over Israeli settlements in the West Bank is all about. Until 3 years ago, it was an Israeli military base, not far from Bethlehem and right next door to the Palestinian town of Beit Sahor. It's inside the West Bank, that area of land that is home to the Palestinians and which was captured and then occupied by Israel in the 1967 war. Now, Israeli settlers want to turn this hilltop into a thriving Jewish community in the heart of the land that is supposed to be a future Palestinian state. Israel's settlement project has been extraordinarily successful. Today, nearly 500,000 Jewish settlers live in East Jerusalem and the West Bank. The settlers at Shtema are led by a woman called Nadia Matar. She lives in Efrat, another settlement not far away. And as far as she is concerned, all of the West Bank, which she calls Judea and Samaria, belongs to the Jewish people, both by biblical and by historical right. She's trying to prevent the creation of a Palestinian state here, and so far, she and others like her have been very successful.
This place, we are now in an abandoned army barrack, abandoned by the IDF 3 years ago because of one of the many agreements by our own government of capitulating to Arab terror and giving away parts of our homeland, or abandoning it, or giving away to the Arabs. This whole camp, this whole hill, is Israeli controlled, and despite this, the Arabs of Beit Sahor, who have plenty of hills, as you can see around us, that are Area A, that they can develop as much as they want, and where they can build a hospital and a neighborhood as much as they want, they want to build their neighborhood on this hill, because it's very clear to us, they don't want what they already have, that's not enough for them. They want to take another piece that belongs to the Jewish people, and we understood this a year ago, and we organized a committee for a Jewish Dema, together with Women in Green, and organize weekly events here in Shtema, cultural events, lectures, concerts, classes, connected with painting the buildings and trying to fixing them a little bit. And we hope, we're here a year and a few months, and we hope that that we will be able to keep this place and convince the political echelon to keep this place and to stop with the capitulations to Arab terror and to finally understand that this land, the land of Israel, belongs to the Jewish people. We're not going to agree to give that little land that we have here away. In its entirety, the land of Israel belongs to the Jewish people. There's enough Arab countries where Arab can have their own states.
The story of Shtema shows how settlements get built. It's all about determined settlers and eventually complicit Israeli authorities. At first, the army didn't let the settlers into Shtema. Now they come once a week, and soon they hope to start living here. The US government is pressuring Israel to stop settlement growth so that there can be a return to serious peace talks with the Palestinians. But on the ground in the West Bank, it's the settlers who seem as strong and influential as ever.
Rory McCarthy reporting from the West Bank. And finally, England's cricketers have regained the Ashes after a thumping victory by 197 runs over Australia at the Oval. The Observer's chief sports writer, Paul Haywood, has followed every ball of the dramatic series and says that the England captain will go down as the hero.
Well, I think these are Andrew Strauss's Ashes, really. England came to the Oval in a very unpromising position. They were really annihilated at Headingley, lost that match by an innings and 80 runs, and Strauss really had to get the team back together, I think, and to persuade them that the damage inflicted in Leeds wasn't going to be terminal at the Oval. And his leadership has been marvellous, really. I think he's distinguished himself as a captain and a batsman in this series, and really I think all the honours go to him.
Now, it was a weaker Australian side than back in 2005, but just how big an achievement is this for English cricket?
Well, I'm just speculating, really, that in 2005 England's talent won them the Ashes to a large degree. This time, I think Australia's comparative mediocrity has played its part. It's a team full of promoted understudies who haven't quite delivered, even though Australia scored 8 test centuries to England's 2 in this series. When it came to it, when Australia only needed to draw at the Oval, they weren't able to close the deal. And I think a lot of attention will be focused on Ponting, and Ponting will probably take the blame. But actually, this Australian side, I think, wasn't as good as they tried to persuade us that it was. On the other hand, England at the Oval, I think, have produced one of the great comebacks, really, given the scale of the task in front of them after Headingley.
So do you think this could be the end of Australia's dominance in Test cricket?
Well, it certainly looks that way. They recovered over the winter against South Africa, and they seem to be, forming a new generation of players, and they certainly talked them up. The likes of Phil Hughes and Mitchell Johnson were going to take over from, Glenn McGrath and Justin Langer and those guys, but it hasn't really happened in this series, and I think some of the players have fallen short. They can be pleased with the efforts of Marcus North, obviously. Hilfenhaus and Siddle have bowled pretty well. Mitchell Johnson recovered from a mid-series wobble, and Michael Clarke batted very well again in the middle of the series. But when it came to it at the end, they were unable really to secure a draw to retain the Ashes, and that reflects pretty badly on an Australian side.
And for England, Andrew Flintoff bowing out, how much are the team going to miss him?
Well, I don't think they'll miss him much at all, actually. His contribution in this series was a rampage from the pavilion end at Lords, which was I think decisive in England winning that Lords test. Since then, he's been playing on one leg pretty much. The decision to leave him out at Headingley, I think, was fully vindicated by the way he played at the Oval. His contribution in this series has been sporadic, and an echo really of his great role in 2005. So, with Stuart Broad's emergence, with six wickets at Headingley and a great five for here at the Oval, I think that England have moved on now, and they found a player to replace Flintoff. It didn't take them very long, did it? Flintoff wasn't even off the field before attention switched to Stuart Broad, and people started to feel that England have found new talent. Jonathan Trott, the batsman, is another one. He looks a certainty for the middle order for the winter. And really, you wouldn't have put much money on England being in this position after five tests, not only regaining the Ashes, but also finding fresh talent.
Paul Hayward reporting from the Oval. That's all for today. I'm Douglas Hardy. The producers, Phil Maynard and Harriet Grant.